And on RN, it's time now for this week's edition of Encounter. Welcome to the program and the third and final instalment of our three-part series on faith and reason. This week, Judaism. We often hear it said that Judaism is about deed rather than creed, and that ethical questions of how to live a good life are far more urgent than theological questions about whether God exists or why he allows the innocent to suffer. And yet, Judaism also has a long and distinguished history of philosophical thought, and the meaning of suffering has been a constant theme in Jewish literature, going all the way back to the book of Job. Well, today we're exploring that darkness, we're taking a tour of the Jewish Enlightenment, and looking at contemporary issues around education and that well-worn stereotype of the Jewish intellectual. The program's produced by me, David Rutledge. If you wanted to draw up a checklist of what religious people are supposed to believe in order to describe themselves as such, you'd probably put the existence of God at the very top. Whether or not you can prove that God exists is a favourite gauntlet for a certain kind of atheist to throw down, and Christians and Muslims are often more than happy to pick it up in the spirit of defending an indispensable pillar of faith. In Judaism, however, the question of the existence of God is all hedged about with ambiguity, and it's just the first of several ambiguities we'll be encountering in this program. Robert Eisen is Professor of Religion and Judaic Studies at George Washington University in Washington, D.C.
It certainly is fundamental. It's fundamental throughout the centuries, certainly up to the modern period, and even once the modern period begins. God is at the center of Judaism, because everything is based on this notion of God creating the world and there being a covenantal relationship between God and the Jewish people. God is certainly central. But I think it's fair to say that Jews were a lot less obsessed with proving the existence of God because they were a lot less obsessed than Christians with belief in general. Jews in the Middle Ages tended to systematize action. They were interested in systematizing law, not systematizing belief. Also, when they finally got around to talking about God, there was a tendency to often, well, because Jews had suffered so much, of seeing God as kind of a hidden presence. Not necessarily absent, but hidden. And so they were much less concerned about God than they were about asking, well, what is it that we need to do in life? What are our religious obligations based on the 613 commandments? From very early on, Christianity made belief a litmus test for whether you were a Christian. And so many of the debates in early Christianity in the 4th, 5th, 6th centuries were about defining precisely what a Christian must believe. That question really, again, just did not concern Jews until well into the Middle Ages. And even then, there weren't very many Jews who discussed this issue. All of the effort, the vast majority of the effort in what's called the rabbinic tradition, the traditions of the rabbis and their literature, is on law and what you do. Now, there was always the assumption that God was there and that God had a special relationship with the Jewish people and that the law mattered. But beyond those basic points, the rabbis and Jews generally just weren't interested that much in discussing the details.
To me personally, the question is, what is the Torah saying to me? How is it going to affect my life, the relationship I have with others?
David Friedman is a rabbi at the Central Synagogue in Bondi Junction in Sydney.
And I think it's a fair comment to say that if you have a group of Jews and you say, well, look, who here believes in God? Who has doubts? Who definitely does not believe in God? We can have the discussion, but at the end of it, we're still Jews. And I think maybe that's the major difference between, as you mentioned, Christianity and Islam, because what links Christians together is Christianity, and what links Islam together is the Muslim faith. But what links Jews together is in part Judaism, but is also in part our Jewish destiny. So where they are linked by faith, we are equally linked by fate. So we have Jews who are observant, we have Jews who are non-observant, we have Jews who attend the synagogue, we have Jews who would never set foot inside a synagogue, but they are Jews, and there is a principle in the Talmud that every Jew is responsible for another Jew, irrespective of their religious leaning. after the Second World War, when so many Jews lost their lives were stolen from them. I suppose it was anti-Semitism to the very nth degree, which is a complete irrational hatred of someone purely because they were Jewish. And in the years after the war, along came one of the great mystic teachers of the post-war period, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who's known as the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he said the antidote to anti-Semitism, to this irrational hatred of Jews, has to be an irrational love of Jews. So every Jew has to have this passion to care for and love his fellow Jew.
So that love and that community spirit transcends the theology, and I guess we're looking at a picture where it's possible to not believe in God at all and yet still identify as a Jew.
Well, I've often questioned whether or not you could convert to Judaism because you love Jewish food and you love Jewish people and whatever else. Could you do that and express a doubt in the oneness of God and in the existence of God? I'm not sure if that would be allowed under our Orthodox rabbinic code. I think there has to be some expression of a divine force in the universe. But it's like anything else. To get into the club, you have to say, I'm going by the rules. But once you're in the club, you can then sort of do your own thing in your own way.
Because Jews experienced so much suffering throughout the ages, they were just less focused on where God was and more focused on how to live a life that was successful. Why dwell on the details of why God exists or how many angels dance on the head of a pin when the real challenge was how to live your life successfully and happily in a situation in which you were often a minority, often being persecuted by your overlords, whether they be Christian or Muslim.
But you say that there is a point in Jewish history at which thinkers or philosophers do turn their attention to belief and start to devote some energy to that discussion. At what point does that happen? Is that through contact with Christianity, or how does that work?
It begins to happen gradually throughout the Middle Ages, but really the great creed, the person who really made the creed in Judaism famous, or the whole idea that you should have a creed, is Maimonides in the 12th century, who lives in the Muslim world. He's in Egypt. And I think that for him, there were a number of different pressures that caused him to think in this way and to be concerned about belief. One that was that he was a philosopher, and philosophers tend to think about metaphysical issues, and therefore it was important for him to systematize Jewish belief. But also, there's the pressure from Islam and from Christianity and Jews being challenged constantly to, either justify your faith or convert. Why don't you become a Christian? Why don't you become a Muslim? So Jews were forced ultimately to come up with a list. And Maimonides does that with his famous list of 13 beliefs that for him become critical to determining whether you're a proper Jew or not.
Are they relevant to Jewish practice today? Is he still somebody that one should read to negotiate some of these tensions around what one believes and why?
Well, should one read Maimonides? Of course. But if you're asking about, because Maimonides spoke about a lot of different things, so maybe the greatest Jewish mind in the Middle Ages. But if you're asking about whether people are concerned about the issue of belief today, we live in a modern era in which most Jews are not concerned about that at all. I think the focus more than ever now is on the way you live your life, what form of Jewish practice you take. But interestingly enough, in the Orthodox world, which is the most observant of the communities, there's also a lot of emphasis nowadays on those 13 principles as a litmus test for determining whether you're a Jew or not. And that's in part because of the chaotic state of the Jewish community with the fragmentation of Judaism in the modern period into all different varieties and denominations. Orthodox Jews are trying to define, both in terms of practice and belief, what is proper Judaism. They've returned to the 13 principles of Maimonides, but they've given it an emphasis that it never really had.
Which is what?
Which is that it was important. The
right.
litmus test for being a Jew was not what you believed. And in fact, people are often surprised to hear that the litmus test for being a Jew throughout the Middle Ages was whether you were born of a Jewish mother. It had nothing to do with practice or belief. It was a genealogical definition. And so, You have this phenomenon, again, that Christians and Muslims don't quite understand, that Judaism is much more than a religion. It's also an ethnic demarcation, a national demarcation, if you live in the state of Israel. And it has very little to do with whether you even believe or practice. You have the phenomenon of the atheist Jew. And when I've used that term with my Christian friends and Muslim friends, they really just draw a blank. They can't understand that because they assume Judaism is just a religion, and it's more than that.
The medieval Jewish philosopher Maimonides lived in the Muslim world, born in Spain under Islamic rule in 1138 and died in Egypt in 1204. His two great masterworks were the Mishnah Torah, which is still considered today by many Jews to be one of the authoritative works of Halakha, or the legal interpretation of scripture, and the famous Guide for the Perplexed, which is one of the earliest attempts to synthesize Jewish faith with philosophical reason. During his lifetime, many of Maimonides' Muslim contemporaries were inclined to dismiss Judaism as being primitive and intellectually backward. And Maimonides was clearly on side with some of this criticism.
He certainly was concerned that many of his Jewish peers held what he would have thought to be wrong beliefs.
That's Tamar Rudavsky, professor of philosophy at The Ohio State University.
He was committed to shifting people's ways of thinking, but he also understood that many people were simply incapable of philosophical thinking, and so it would have been very difficult to move them forward. And so he's, on the one hand, sensitive to where they're coming from, recognizing the, you know, the deep folk belief, and on the other hand, committed to a philosophical worldview and a philosophical way of thinking about God and Judaism, wanting to move people along this new way of thinking.
So what are some of the outlines of his philosophy with regard to Judaism? What issues in Judaism or Jewish community life is he taking up in his writing and his thought?
As I see it, what he's trying to do for the most part, if you want to just give a blanket description, I would say that he is devoted his entire life to integrating the philosophical worldview and the halachic worldview. Maimonides makes this his imperative, that one can be a halachic, Torah observant Jew and also fully accept the philosophical world represented by Aristotle and the Arab philosophers. And so he just runs all the topics through this harmonization scheme. Looks at the problem of God, how we can describe God, what we can say about God. He looks at creation. He looks at the whole issue of divine providence and the problem of evil. In the introduction to the guide, and the very famous introduction, Maimonides explicitly states that he's writing the guide for the perplexed for that individual who, having read Aristotle, now has doubts pertaining to his faith in Judaism. And Maimonides says in the introduction that the purpose of the guide is to enable such an individual to reconcile both the rational and the faith traditions.
He also wants to establish, doesn't he, that any facets of Judaism which seem contrary to reason are actually based on mistaken interpretations of Scripture. But of course, if we look at the Hebrew Scriptures, we find many instances where God explicitly sort of goes out of his way to defy human reason. And I always think of the story of Abraham and Isaac here, that you have this exemplar of faith who's prepared to murder his child on instruction from the deity. It's a morally incoherent tale. I mean, how does Maimonides rationalize a text like that and bring it into line with philosophical reason?
Well, you're assuming there that we know what God is and how God behaves and that we can actually talk articulately about God. But of course, that's one of the major challenges Maimonides has to religious language. Maimonides reminds us that ultimately we know nothing about God. He spends in chapters 50 to 59 of part one of the guide laying out very carefully, based on Aristotelian logic and language, a view according to which we can't say, for example, of God that God is good or that God is omniscient or God is omnipotent. Those words are meaningless. This is the, you know, very famous conclusion he arrives at. Reminds me always of Wittgenstein, praise unto God is insult. Best to remain silent. In fact, he's quoting Psalms there. But best to remain silent. And so any predication of God is simply mistaken. And so even asking the question, how do we understand a God who allows Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, is a form of presumptuousness that we understand the ways of God. In a sense, Maimonides is taking very seriously the notion of God as a mysterium tremendum, that mysterious being about whom we can say or know or understand absolutely nothing. And that, for Maimonides, is a consummately rational way of thinking about God. It's not irrational. It's those individuals who think they can talk about God who actually are irrational.
Tamar Rudavsky. On RN, you're listening to Encounter and the third program in our three-part series on faith and reason. This week, we're looking at Judaism. Maimonides' project of transforming Judaism into a rational system was controversial in his time. Indeed, after he died, many of his books were burned. But if we leap forward some 500 years to the European Enlightenment, a time of intense intellectual innovation and the golden age of philosophical reason in the West, we find Judaism once again coming under pressure to define itself in rational terms, and the Jew positioned as a sort of negative image of the civilized rational thinker. Here's Adam Sutcliffe, senior lecturer in early modern history at King's College London and the author of Judaism and Enlightenment.
It's really, really hard to say what precisely reason is. It has many different meanings in different hands. It's practiced in different ways. It's much easier to say what reason isn't. And so the Jews were available, both historically and as actual living Jews in Europe, to point out and say, well, what we are as Enlightenment rational thinkers is not that, the opposite of that. So we, in the Enlightenment, we look towards the future, towards casting a better world. What's the quintessence of something unchanging, fossilized, you know, eternal and rigid? People thought of Judaism as a religion that fundamentally didn't really change. The idea of a universal truth for everybody, really emblematic of the Enlightenment, that was opposed to a particularist view that was associated with Judaism, a people apart from others who wanted to keep separate. And then just looking at ways of being in the world, being modern was all about being dapper and fashionable and part of high society in the centers of Europe. Jewish neighborhoods, ghettos, areas of unfamiliarity where Jews clustered and lived, rabbinic figures seen as bearded and dusty and remote, these were figures of difference and tradition and insularity and primitivism, against which the fashionably bewigged Enlightenment philosophers saw themselves as the opposite.
Judaism's position in 18th century European culture was a paradoxical one. On one hand, as we've heard, many Enlightenment philosophers took a very dim view of Jewish culture. But on the other hand, the intellectual products of that culture were often put to strategic use by those same philosophers.
One of the fascinating aspects of 18th century writing is it's extremely playful, and people loved publishing texts that were anonymous, writing in one voice, which isn't actually the voice of the author, throws you off the scent of the author, men writing as if they were women, non-Jews writing as if they were Jews, and indeed sometimes using Jewish texts, but playing with them so that they are writing from a very complex position. And there was a particular allure to criticizing Christianity from a Jewish starting point and have the Jew come out on top. Because if Christianity is losing the argument from Jews, and Jews, people thought everybody knew, Jewish rabbis were the ultimate in legalistic, narrow-minded nonsense, then really Christianity is on the ropes. So what we find circulating in the early 18th century in particular are a number of rewritten versions of 17th century Jewish critiques of Christianity, written for an internal Jewish audience, really to fortify Jewish pride in Judaism and to argue against those Jews who are backsliding back into Christianity. These texts were written to fortify the Jewish faith for people such as them. Christians got their hands on them, not so much Christians really, Enlightenment critics of Christianity. They played with them and they used Jewish arguments with a twist as part of their arsenal against mainstream Christianity. I don't think that means, though, that the Enlightenment was getting arguments from Jews that they didn't to some extent have already. It wasn't that Judaism was the source of Enlightenment critiques of Christianity in some important way. That's sometimes argued by historians who want to big up, if you will, the Jewish contribution, as it's presented sometimes in a rather old-fashioned way. I'd say rather that it's part of this very complicated interplay between Jewish texts and Christian texts, between the actual Jews who write some of those texts or sell them or show them to Christians. It's part of the very fertile interplay of thought and debate around religion in this period, where everything is up for grabs and everything is very mobile.
And so into this intellectual ferment comes Moses Mendelssohn, born in 1729 in what would later become Germany and the father of what's often called the Jewish Enlightenment. Can you tell us about Mendelssohn and his contribution?
Moses Mendelssohn is a fascinating figure. He's a major intellectual in Berlin in the mid to late 18th century, and he's really the only Jew in that period to be taken really seriously as a philosopher, as a thinker in the German Enlightenment, while also being recognized as a Jew, and indeed an observant Jew. Mendelssohn lived in two worlds, really. On the one hand, he was a friend of Lessing, the major German dramatist. He contributed to German debates on the origins of language, on the immortality of the soul. He worked in a kind of mainstream German Enlightenment tradition, trying to show how a moderated, rational Enlightenment form of religion could be made compatible with Enlightenment philosophy. He also was pressured to explain how the two could be seen as compatible, because many of his peers, while fascinated by Mendelssohn, really couldn't understand that if he was so enlightened and rational, he carried on observing Jewish law. And he was repeatedly needled to defend his Jewish observance in enlightened terms. He was resistant to doing this. He preferred to keep his two spheres separate. But eventually, after repeated challenges that became increasingly barbed in the first years of the 1780s, he wrote a very interesting book called Jerusalem, which was published in 1783, which is his attempt to defend Judaism in rational Enlightenment terms. And it's a very interesting argument. He argues, on the one hand, that Christians who attack Judaism are very ill-advised to do so because Judaism is the foundation of Christianity, and if they try to pull out Judaism, that's the ground floor of their own house, and the whole house will come crumbling down. He then goes on to argue that Judaism is in fact more rational than Christianity, because unlike Christianity, it isn't a religion based on any dogmas that are outside reason, such as the Trinity. He points at the Trinity in Christianity and says, that's something that you just have to believe. There's no way of squaring it with reason. It doesn't make sense rationally. It's just a dogmatic tenet. Judaism, he says, has no actual dogmas. You don't have to believe anything as a Jew other than what you'd believe anyway as a decent, rational person. You have to believe in the moral truths that are themselves self-evident to our rational minds. What Judaism does have is a set of observances that you are mandated to practice in order to remind yourself of these ethical truths and to keep you close to living ethically in the world.
Adam Sutcliffe. And on RN, you're listening to Encounter.
Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare, if you know. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? And who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Who shut in the sea with doors, when it burst forth from the womb, when I made clouds its garment, and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed bounds for it, and set bars and doors, and said, thus far shall you come, and no further, and here shall your proud waves be stayed. Have you commanded the morning since your days began, and caused the dawn to know its place? Have you entered into the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been opened unto you? And have you seen the doors of the shadow of death? Deck yourself with majesty and dignity. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. Pour forth the overflowing of your anger. Look upon everyone that is proud and abase him, and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them all in the dust together. Bind their faces in the world below. Then will I acknowledge to you that your own hand can save you.
The book of Job tells the story of a righteous man who suffers terrible affliction as the result of a kind of casual wager between God and Satan. And when Job calls on God to explain himself, he receives the answer we've just heard. Taken at face value, it's not a particularly helpful response to someone who's trying to understand the age-old theological conundrum of why God allows bad things to happen to good people. But Jewish rabbinic interpretation has never been about taking texts at face value. David Friedman.
Why do the righteous suffer? That's the ultimate question. But for me, it seems to imply that what is significant is not my understanding of God, but rather God's appreciation of who I am and what I've become. And the book says, you will never understand my essence. But the Bible itself starts in the same way. In fact, the book of Job in Talmudic literature is considered a very old book. Job is, even though it comes later in the Bible, Job is almost a contemporary of Moses. And so to relate it to the early chapters of Genesis would not be too far-fetched. So if you take, for example, the opening, however you translate the Hebrew words Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, it doesn't explain the origin of God. All that's important is that we understand our place in this universe in relation to God, and then our place or our role in this universe in relation to each other. It's one of those fascinating aspects of Judaic literature that the Talmud never starts on page one. Few Jewish books start on page one. We always start on page two. And again, even if you look at the letter of the alphabet with which, and the rabbis ask this question many times, the first letter of the Bible is the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet, the letter bet. The first letter is aleph, like the Greek letters alpha, beta. We have aleph, bet. So they say, why is the second letter chosen? Why wouldn't we start with the first letter of the alphabet? And the rabbis explain that the very shape of the letter, which is almost like three sides of a square, that you can go only one way out. You can go, so to speak, forwards, but you can't go backwards through that line. That's our destiny as human beings, to look forward, to improve, and not worry too much about the past, or in this case, not worry too much. God has got God's things to worry about. We have our things to worry about.
The suffering of the Jewish people down the ages is a theological mystery, but it's also a social and historical one. The Enlightenment was the age of Jewish emancipation, which saw the granting of equality and citizenship rights to Jews throughout Europe, and it promised the inauguration of a modern era in which liberal ideals of justice and human rights, built on the bedrock of rational philosophy, would ensure the dignity and harmonious coexistence of all citizens. So the question is, why did these Enlightenment ideals offer so little protection to European Jews from the horrors that would unfold in the mid-20th century? Adam Sutcliffe.
That is a huge question. In some ways, that was the central question that people were asking in the Nazi period. How could Nazi ideology with this murderous anti-Semitism arise in the heartland of the European Enlightenment, in the land of poets and philosophers, the land of Kant and Hegel? And part of the reason why many bourgeois German Jews didn't leave Germany until the last minute, or didn't think about leaving until it was too late, was because the ideals of the Enlightenment were nowhere more entrenched, nowhere was there more faith in the values of the Enlightenment, really, than in the German Jewish urban cultural elites, who felt that those values, those universal values, had really become their new religion. I think one of the most interesting attempts to answer the question you've posed was put forward by two German Jewish exiles from Germany, Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer, who were philosophers in Frankfurt, and they left Frankfurt as refugees just before World War II and went to California. And during the war in 1944, they published a fascinating book called Dialectic of Enlightenment, which was really trying to understand what was going on in their homeland. And their view was that a very complex kind of envy was at the core of the dynamic of anti-Semitism in Europe. And the envy was based on the fact that the Enlightenment had in some ways eviscerated European sense of meaning in their lives and their understanding of who they were and where they came from and where they were going. And Jews, although they had been criticized in the Enlightenment tradition and were still being criticized in Nazi ideology for being primitive and backward and tribal and superstitious, in a sense, really, it was precisely those elements of myth in Jewish identity and self-understanding that other Europeans were left feeling envious of, because rather than attempting to overthrow myth altogether and create a view of modernity that was rational in its tenets and an understanding of the basis of European nationhood as somehow rational in its grounding, the essence of Judaism remained, you could call it tribal, certainly textually based. And even if many Jews had disaffiliated or moved to very different and complicated relationships with their Jewishness, in essence, Judaism remained a religion based on peoplehood, based on an ancient text, which itself had at its core some kind of notion of divine revelation. And this mythic understanding of peoplehood that had a past, had a present, and had some view into the future, this is what the Enlightenment had tried to squeeze out of European cultural understanding, and yet Europeans couldn't really live without it. So Horkheimer and Adorno, they weren't opposing the Enlightenment, certainly not, but they were trying to acknowledge that some element of myth and of accommodation of myth was really, really important in the modern world, and Judaism had held on to that.
And it's interesting, and I suppose horribly ironic, that this re-mythologization of a people and, you know, a sense of peoplehood, I mean, this was the kind of thing that the Nazis were trying to synthesize for themselves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is the central irony, that even as they were trying to denigrate Jewish peoplehood and myths, they were rebuilding a set of myths around German folk. But they were trying to reinvent something that the Jews had invented already and had never really quite let go of. So hopefully, and I think this is how I would want to read Horkheimer and Adorno, it isn't a question of choosing between the Enlightenment and myth. We need to find a way of holding the two together in our minds. And if we fail to do that, then there is a danger that Enlightenment become the Enlightenment tradition, the rational tradition, becomes too cold for us to sustain our sense of self in the world. It's important to remember also, of course, that the Enlightenment didn't just lead to Nazism, it also led to Jewish emancipation, the very notions of equality before the law, human rights, toleration of difference. These are key tenets that emerge from the Enlightenment tradition, without which there wouldn't have been the move towards emancipation for Jews, for slaves, racial equality, gender equality. We can't think of, you know, building a just society without the traditions of the Enlightenment, but I think we have to be mindful as well of what perhaps we need beyond the Enlightenment and of the perils of somehow trying to start with a tabula rasa.
Well, Judaism today is undergoing something of a theological renaissance, and this is very much in keeping with its protean talent for reinterpreting the old in light of the new. Here's Jo Ellen Green-Kaiser, Executive Director of the Media Consortium, a progressive journalism organisation based in San Francisco.
I think one of the most interesting theological developments actually came as a result of LGBT Jews. It's been the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender Jews who've really thought deeply about how a fluid identity could be practiced in a way that was affirmative rather than an expression of absence. And what they've done is they've started pioneering a new idea of Jewish identity and Jewish theology that's based on a very old concept within Judaism of B'Tselem Elohim. B'Tselem Elohim is literally in the image of God. And what LGBT Jews do with that is suggest that whoever we are and whatever we practice, we have God inside of us, so that we don't need to search outside of ourselves for God, that learning and looking at other human beings actually tells us most about what is the most spiritual. And that's very consistent with Jewish religion. Jewish religion always has said, don't look into the afterlife. Look, whatever you do, look here on earth. Here on earth is where you're going to find the essence of spirituality. It's in your everyday practice. It's in the way you eat food. It's in the way you go to the bathroom. Spirituality is rooted in who we are and where we are.
And of course, feminism has been a founding moment in the development of this new kind of theology, hasn't it? What role has feminism played in Jewish intellectual life more broadly?
Jewish feminism was critical in opening up Jewish practice to women, just as feminism did in secular culture. So you have women like Judith Plaskow, Blue Greenberg in the Orthodox community, who basically insisted that women be able to have the same role in Jewish life as men did. And that effort is actually continuing in the Orthodox world. That Jewish women have succeeded in liberal Judaism, in the Reform, Reconstructionist, conservative movements here in the United States, in having absolutely equal roles with men. In the Orthodox world, there's still a lot of struggle around that. But it's actually surprising how much has been done. It's been really, really amazing work.
Feminism can mean lots of different things. I mean, in a sense, I want to suggest that the whole notion of feminism is paradoxical.
Tamar Rudavsky.
On the one hand, it's an outgrowth of the Enlightenment itself. I mean, one can see it as a critique of the Enlightenment, but I want to suggest that it really develops as a result of the Enlightenment. Because what is it that Enlightenment philosophers and thinkers are doing? They're emphasizing reason. And by emphasizing reason, they're actually, ironically, putting women back in the picture. So if you think back, for example, to Aristotle, famously distinguishes between matter and form, between the active and the passive principle, the intellectual and the corporeal, the male and the female. And from Aristotle on, throughout the history of philosophy, through the church fathers, the female was always associated with the material, inert, passive, corporeal, non-intellectual principle. Come the Enlightenment, all of a sudden, we're thinking about men and women in terms of their rational faculty. And so by bringing reason to the forefront, women were able to make the claim, we're rational too. So that's on the one hand. But on the other hand, you'll find in contemporary feminist writings that many feminists reject the rational altogether And so what we have seen is a backlash against what we might call rationalist epistemology. And we see contemporary feminists moving back toward what we might call a reappropriation of the body. We're now saying what's bodily, what's corporeal, what's physical is good, and we should privilege what's physical. And so one might see that as a reaction against the Enlightenment emphasis upon reason and rationality. And I think that's another reason why so many contemporary feminists are drawn to the continental tradition, because the continental tradition, unlike the Anglo-American analytic tradition, the continental tradition really embraces the irrational, passions, emotions, bodies, the physical.
In its various post-Enlightenment sympathies, the continental philosophical tradition valorizes certain aspects of human culture that have been traditionally associated with Judaism. Jewish identity is often said to be fluid and paradoxical, with elusive foundations forged through the experience of exile and very much wedded to the idea of the world as a great text, ripe for interpretation, with truth that speaks in many voices. Well, these, of course, are all postmodern ideals, and so it's not surprising that postmodern thinkers have been inclined to celebrate all things Jewish. Robert Eisen.
You know, it's very interesting because for a long time in the modern period, Judaism was considered to be a primitive faith. You know, Christians had a very negative view of it. And, all of a sudden in the last few decades, Judaism is in. The Judaism of the rabbis is in. The Talmud is in. And the Talmud, you know, for years was just as, you know, for centuries was vilified, you know, as being a, you know, a kind of a text that no one should pay any attention to because of all of the Talmudic hair splitting and all of its argumentation. What good did it do? Arguments that went nowhere and didn't seem to have any resolution. Well, nowadays, everybody's into that. Everybody is into arguments, or at least the belief that maybe arguments don't have any final conclusion, that there aren't any grand theories anymore. That paradox and ambiguity, well, that's really where this is really where we are in the modern period, because there are no more isms. There are no more overarching theories that can explain everything. So the pluralism, the disorganization of Jewish thinking when it comes to philosophy and law has now being lionized is a wonderful thing. And it is very postmodern. However, as is often the case with these sweeping generalizations, you do have to be careful. Because as I said earlier, I don't know if the rabbis would have related entirely to the postmodern way of thinking, in which there really are not necessarily any isms. The rabbis generally did believe in a God. They did believe in the chosenness of the Jewish people. They did believe in the 613 commandments being the way to worship God. So it wasn't a free-for-all. Paradox and ambiguity were not the last word. There were some parameters.
Judaism as a religion was always a very strange religion in that it was based around a place, Jerusalem. It didn't have a particular figure or set of figures that the religion circled around. It circled around this place and around an agrarian world. And when Jews went into exile, they no longer had that place. They were placeless. All you had left was a language, Hebrew, and a text. And so Jews really did become the people of the book. It was a fluid identity. It was what we would now think of as a postmodern identity. It was created because we were an exilic people. What I think that a lot of contemporary theorists don't understand is that that kind of postmodern identity is not playful or joyful. I mean, I'm sorry, Deleuze, you know, but I just don't. It's not a happy thing to be having one of these kinds of fluid identities. I mean, for intellectuals, it's fun. But, you know, for most people, this is not a joyful experience to be floating in a sea of textuality. People don't like it. And so what you find is that as soon as Jews were able to exit exile, as soon as Jews were able to find themselves in a role that was non-diasporic, they immediately attempted to assume a modern identity. So you have an incredible attraction between like U.S. Jews and the state of Israel, they went back to the idea of a state. And that that can't be overemphasized. And I had been sort of hoping in the 90s that possibly the pull of the state would not be so strong and that some parts of the Jewish world would be able to take the incredibly rich textured identity that had been developed in exile and find another form of expression for it that was maybe more grounded or maybe centered, but centered in a way other than the modernist way, centered in some kind of new theology. But on the whole, I've been very depressed, actually, that I think that most people have run screaming from fluid identity into the embrace of a Jewish state, which is incredibly problematic itself.
Another stereotype commonly associated with Judaism is the idea that Jews are natural intellectuals. Education and learning are certainly important in Jewish culture for all sorts of interesting historical reasons. But does that mean that there's an intrinsic affinity among Jews for the life of the mind? Robert Eisen.
Well, I'd like to believe that Jews are inherently smart.
Sure.
But because that would make my life a lot easier, but and the life of my children a lot easier. But I don't believe that. Now, there are some people who have tried. In fact, I just read a review of a book recently that, you know, someone tries to show that, in fact, there are genealogical or biological evolutionary reasons why Jews evolved to be smart. I don't buy the biological issue or the biological argument. My feeling is that it's precisely as you stated, that it really comes from a rabbinic tradition that became obsessive about study, obsessive about developing the mind. And so the accomplishments of Jewish intellectuals in the modern period, to my mind, is an outgrowth of this. Now I really do hasten to add that many of those Jewish intellectuals were not necessarily religious Jews, and some of them weren't really attached to Judaism at all. But the emphasis, the obsession with learning became so ingrained in Jewish culture that it has carried over in Jewish culture, even when the religious and metaphysical foundations of that practice have gone by the wayside.
This whole idea of the Jewish intellectual is part of the complex of anti-Semitism and the reaction around it to some extent. I think that Jews had very few roles in the societies that they found themselves, and so they ended up in really particular sectors of society. They often couldn't own land, so it was hard to be farmers. So they kind of got shunted into like basically what was white collar professions, and then sort of talked about as having those kind of professions. On the other hand, in the same way, because we were exilic, as I had said before, in theological and cultural terms, we ended up being a people of the book, and it became critical for every Jew to be able to read, to be able to understand the book, preferably to know Hebrew. So Jewish boys were always taught Hebrew. The idea was that the only thing that held Jews together was language, and so everyone had to know language. And so that emphasis on language, along with the emphasis on sort of where the job opportunities were, led to Jews self-identifying as people who, you know, were more white-collar, who would do that. And I think one of the great reactions of the early Zionists in the founding of Israel was to protest and say, hey, we can be just as good farmers as anyone else. There was a sense of that being identified as intellectuals had actually been harmful for Jews, and had there was a certain strain that said that because Jews saw themselves as intellectuals, we hadn't fought back enough in the Holocaust, which I don't believe, but there was a real concern. Let me put it this way. There was a concern within the Jewish community that we were over-identified as intellectuals.
Jews love books. And you can always tell when you go into a Jewish home, it is surrounded by books. And you know, when books fall on, sometimes they fall out of your hand, they fall on the floor, you will always see from a very early age, if it's a religious book, it doesn't matter if it's a Jewish boy or girl of 8 years old, 9 years old, or if it's an adult of 50 or 60, they pick it up, they kiss it. And when these books have gone past their use-by date, they hand them in to the rabbi. They'll say, are you going to the cemetery in the near future? And I'll say, yeah, I've got a funeral tomorrow. please take these prayer books, or please take these Bibles with you. And we treat them as if they were human beings. We bury them in a grave with a Jewish person. So, yes, learning is vitally important. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, which in some respects is the ultimate text of faith, beginning with, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." And it moves on, "And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might." And then it says, "These words which I put on your heart today, you shall teach them diligently to your children, and you shall speak of them when you sit in your house or when you walk by the way." Most people understand that. You shall teach the words to your children and speak these words to your children. But one rabbi told me once, he thought that the real meaning was, if you teach these words to your children, then you will always be able to speak about your children with pride. Somebody will mention your child's name and you won't be embarrassed or humiliated, because they have grasped the nettle and they are carrying the flag of Judaism and Jewish values into the next generation, into the future.
So is that teaching and that commandment among the 613 that talks about the value of learning for its own sake, is this why we see today an extraordinary preponderance among Nobel Prize winners of Jews and the Jewish intellectual, you know, this stereotype that doesn't really exist in Christianity or Islam? We don't really hear Christian or Muslim intellectuals described as such very often, but everybody knows the Jewish intellectual. Is that what's behind that?
Well, I like to think it's the study of Talmud over generations. It's extremely scientific. It's all logic. And I suppose that's how the Jewish mind, that's the Jewish psyche. So I don't know. There is a very high proportion of Jews in relation to other religions who've won Nobel Prizes and who've achieved. But I think if you look in Australia, other minorities do very well as well. I mean, if you look at the HSC results every year, the Chinese, the Koreans, etc., they do exceptionally well. So it may well also be something to do with being a member of a minority. And you know that you always have to strive that little bit harder to get to the top, because there's too many people out there trying to push you down.
On RN, you've been listening to Encounter and the final program in our three-part series on faith and reason. The Voice of God, reading from the Book of Job, was by Simon Chilvers, and studio producer this week was Timothy Nicastri. Don't forget to check the Encounter website, where you'll find a transcript for each program in the Faith and Reason series, as well as streaming audio and podcast links so you can listen again. And you can also leave a comment. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for your company this week. I'm David Rutledge.